Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Nutrition Network. And today we're extremely lucky to have with us today Yvonne Thompson. And Yvonne started this amazing charity, which is called UK Harvest. I came across it because it is a local charity to me, although it is national. And so we're based, or I'm based in Chichester. And so it's really lovely to have that. Such a fantastic charity in our own backyard, so to speak. So Yvonne, welcome. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good. Well, listen, tell us, for those who don't know what UK Harvest is, what is UK Harvest?
UK Harvest is an environmental charity. It collects food from farms, supermarkets and other outlets, and it feeds hungry people. 83% of what we collect is perishable, so it's high nutritional value, albeit fruits and veg, lean proteins, that kind of thing. We work with 350,000 people, so we support a lot of people. We give our food to charities so that they can use the food to feed the people that they support rather than using their money to buy food. And we also, I suppose, we feed lots of individual people, but the key component of our organisation is education. So we want to educate absolutely everyone across the spectrum, because 70% of food waste happens in the household. And so the big thing for us is making sure that people can cook well for less and can actually make sure they get as much nutrition into their diet as possible, particularly pertinent to children who are not in any way, shape or form ready to learn when their diet's high carb, high sugar, and they suffer from those high sugar highs and then those massive lows. We work throughout the UK. So we do everything from the Orkneys all the way through the UK, and we do a lot of education digitally, which we had to do during COVID so that we could reach people. We've had last year 11,000 people came through our 6-week education programme, which covers a broad spectrum of things. And we do employ nutritionists here so that when we have really eclectic pieces of food, we can shove a recipe in so that people know what they can do with it. And we do try to have as much fun as is humanly possible.
Well, that's the thing, which is, you know, I always say, don't let the nutritionist lead the flavour of the food, otherwise it's a disaster, you know. So, you know, cooks are also important, aren't they, about creating something that is really, I always think that food is something, you know, very visceral, obviously, and it's something very bodily, somatic, so that, you know, these days everything's in your head, in effect, because we're looking at devices and all the rest. Food is the one thing that actually is so much about the body, obviously. So with this project, I was just wondering what actually started you off. I mean, what was the sort of spark, if there was one?
So there was a spark. So I know all the farms locally. I used to work for a local authority, and I used to run planning policy and housing, homelessness and all the sort of, I suppose, enabling building houses for people in housing need. And I had seen a project in Australia where they did some food rescue and was quite inspired by that. And so came back here, and we were able to get a van donated in a double garage, and I went out, and the first place we went to was Barfoots, which is a local farmer, and they gave us some food, and we delivered it to Stone Pillow, which is a rough sleeping charity. So the charities that we sort of work with do tend to be sort of around the mental health, homelessness, or supporting women in domestic violence sort of side of the world. Or schools. We do a lot of work with schools. So we started off very small, and that was in the summer of 2017. We now have 8 vans. We have about 40 staff. We have a purpose-built Nourish Hub, and we call our education programme Nourish Ed. So it's about Nourish education. So it's all about nutrition. And so the hub in London is probably about £1.6 million fit out. And it's got a great big space, and we feed people on a donate as you dine basis. So people come along, they can eat with us if they have no money. If they have some money, they can make a donation. And it's about tackling social isolation and loneliness. And we're cooking vegetarian. One of the reasons for that is it's about pumping as much fruit and veg into people as we possibly can, but also it means that particularly in places like London, it doesn't matter what their faith is, they can come and eat with us, because otherwise, you know, we'd sort of tie ourselves up in knots. So we've got a big training kitchen up there where we teach people to cook, and that's the best fun. We've also, in Donington near Chichester, we've got a big training kitchen here as well, and we do lots of stuff, but we do try to go the extra mile. So the people that we work with in our hubs tend to be refugees and asylum seekers, people with learning disabilities, or people with mental health issues, particularly those that are still in hospital and aren't ready to quite come out into the community. So we do tend to try and go the extra mile.
And how do you sort of choose who you work with? I mean, obviously there must be a phenomenal need. What sort of criteria? I mean, obviously you've said it's sort of mental health, women's charities, and but how does somebody get to work with you?
I mean, I think one of the difficult things for us is COVID. We had to really open our doors, particularly to those that were vulnerable and isolated and couldn't get a supermarket slot. You know, you sort of Waitrose, Tesco's, whatever. And so we did lots of deliveries to individuals. But the people that we're trying to get out of the COVID cycle at the moment, a lot of people are dependent on free food. We're trying to bridge that gap by doing pantries. Now, a pantry is a model where someone can come along and they can pay £2.50 and get a bag of food, which gets them a bit more resilient into paying for the shopping. And we're starting to do quite a lot of that. We can't work with as many charities as we like. We don't have enough food, and also our resources are stretched pretty thin. So we have a waiting list of charities, but for us, it tends to be charities that we're ethically aligned with. So it is people that want to do stuff for the greater good, or schools. We do a lot of stuff with schools, mainly because school holiday hunger is a big thing for us. We don't get any money from the government, so we've got to raise every penny to do anything, but we run school holiday hunger programs through all holidays, and we do activities, everything from growing to cooking to learning about food to working out what's what and where does it grow. And I mean, there's all sorts of educational stuff that goes into that, but the difficulty is, say, we don't try to say no to people, but we've had to recently say no to quite a few groups because we just don't have the capacity.
Well, I mean, it must be a very difficult thing to prioritize on. And I think definitely, you know, obviously it sounds like schools are somewhat of a sort of at the top of the list somewhere there in that list of priorities. And absolutely, I mean, it must be the right thing to do to speak to these children early on about all of these things, so those habits are formed, you know, and embedded in there. Because, you know, we're in Chichester. I remember seeing, you know, my daughter go to school, walking her up to Central, which is a local school here, and people, the kids diving into Poundland for their breakfast. That was it. You know, it's just like, woo. So that's the reality for quite a few people. And even in a so-called rich city like Chichester, which it, obviously, you know, there's a really underbelly here in Chichester, as there are in all cities, you know, that tend to get ignored. So, yeah, so basically when you're going into schools, obviously it's education as well. How does that look? I mean, how do you start with interesting people about food? I mean, because obviously you've alluded to the other sort of food which they're reliant on, you know, the carbs and the sugary stuff is so addictive. I mean, how do you actually even inspire anybody to take interest in this?
I mean, we do a lot of pop-ups. So one of the things that we find is the people that we want to engage with are not necessarily the ones that are easiest to engage with. So we do lots of pop-ups. So, for example, we did a pop-up one day in London. We just pop up, we cook food, we talk to people about what we've cooked, we have somewhere for them to sit, we engage with them, we have a chat about it. But for us, it's all about how do we turn their heads round. I mean, we do one-to-ones, which I know sounds a bit nuts, but we've been doing them by phone or digitally, because a lot of the people that we want to reach are particularly women on low incomes that probably work very, very hard and have no time. We managed to get a donation of thousands of slow cookers. So we've been doing slow cooker courses where we've said, right, do this. put it on, goes to work, come back, there's your meal. And what do we do with the leftovers? We do this. And then we're getting them to keep the chicken bones and things like that. And then saying, right, let's boil that up for stock now. Let's make a soup, you know. So trying to eke things out as much as possible, but still have a very, very healthy meal. I think one of the things for us is we've done quite a lot around malnutrition and obesity. And mainly, I think, because we are fun. And we don't talk about the fact that people are malnourished or obese, and generally they sit hand in glove, we're finding, more and more. But I think one of the nice inroads for us is the schools, because we delivered during the pandemic, particularly during lockdowns, a ton of food to quite a lot of the local primary schools, and we engage with the parents that way, and we've managed to maintain those relationships and get them plugged into the education. We work with a local football club and it's dads and sons, and they do a lot of cooking with us. So I think for us, we will work with almost anybody, but we also do a lot of partnership work. So Aldingbourne Trust, with people with learning disabilities, do a lot with them. Apple Jam, a lot with them. But actually, sometimes the people that you want to engage with are so difficult to reach. And I think that's the big problem, because you want to change the life chances of these young people, but getting the buy-in from the parents is key. But actually, if we can get the kids to cook and then they can teach their mum and dad, isn't that even better? But that we do quite like to do a lot of family cooking. But I think for us, we go to farmers markets as well, and we'll just talk to anybody. We have a really good strong relationship with Vitacress, who grow all the herbs, and so they give us lots of herbs, and we're able to give those out as a medium to engage. But we are using food as a medium to engage with people, but working with them at their level, in their way, at their pace, because a lot of people are not ready to think about things. And we did actually have a fantastic woman who'd never turned her cooker on, who was saying, my cooker's broken, and we were saying, you know the switch at the back there, maybe slick that, put that down. She popped it down, she went, oh, I wondered what that was for. She'd lived in that house for 15 years.
No, really? Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, this is interesting, because I actually do also, I'm doing an MA in anthropology of food, which actually I had to put on pause for the pandemic. But, you know, so it's really about cultures, and, you know, as well as being obviously a nutritional therapist. And it's about the idea of losing food knowledge. I mean, it's sort of, that's a sort of big recurrent theme in anthropology of food. So do you think that, how long has it taken for us to lose this knowledge of food, so that people really are looking at a chicken carcass and not knowing that you can turn that into a stock, or you know, basically, what's the story? I mean, is it a long thing, or like generations, like three generations back, or is it a recent thing, do you think?
I mean, I think one of the things is it depends where you are on the social spectrum, basically. So I think we're into what, fourth generation unemployment now, where we can find families that have been unemployed for four generations. I think culturally, I think I'm Scottish. We're brought up in the kitchen. Everyone cooks. You learn from your gran as you're a child. My mother cooks, we all cook. I have four daughters, they all cook, but we spend most of our time in the kitchen. I think what's happened is society has evolved. I think people are much more, they're not used to sitting around a dining room table for a start, so a lot of people do not sit and socialise down around a dining room table. And actually, one of the saddest things for me is that sort of acknowledgement that a lot of young people are doing their homework lying on the floor, because there is no hard surface for them to use as a desk, or you know, even there's no dining room table, there's nothing. And actually, I think the evolution of the digital age, television, the whole kit and caboodle. I mean, I cannot ever remember not sitting around a dining room table to eat. My children, I once did an experiment with them where I said, tonight we're not going to sit around the table to eat. And they said to me, have you gone mad? Yeah. Now, the young people we're working with, after every session that we cook, we all sit down together and eat. And particularly care leavers, or even young carers who are caring for a parent, they're not used to sitting down and actually having a conversation, or, you know, really enjoying that food. And I think it's that appreciation of it. So food has become fast, quick, You know, it's not. And so I'm part of the slow food movement. So I think the big thing for me is it is about absolutely appreciating and getting the joy out of food. The joy has been lost. And that's the bit that I find absolutely fascinating, because I spend all my time thinking about what am I going to cook next and what's it going to, and what, you know, and I really like it. I'm a big foodie. But actually to see people get enthusiasm, particularly people for first time cooks. So I'm not sure if it isn't, you know, 2-3 generations down the line, but I'm pretty sure interwar people cooked all the time. They had no option. So that's the interwar period. After the Second World War, I'm pretty sure people still cooked. And actually that sort of interwar generation are probably healthier, or were healthier than we are now, because it's the fast food, it's, you know, the high carb, high sugar rubbish. I mean, I looked at the ingredients of a vegan burger the other day, and I thought you'd get more nutrition licking the pavement than you would out this vegan burger, because there's no food in it. So I think these are the things that I find fascinating. But I reckon it's the, you know, the 60s, 70s and coming into that fast food of the 80s, and it's stuck. So actually a lot of people love a McDonald's. They love it. And actually for me, I'd rather spend my time cooking something lovely, because I get joy out of it, than having fast food. But we're in a fast food sort of situation at the moment. And I'm on the underground a lot in London, and I see people and they're just having takeaway food all the time.
Yeah, I think it's just such a difficult thing, isn't it? Because it's this whole societal problem, which food is just a component of, I imagine. Because, you know, like I was brought up in the 60s. I know Yvonne's already said I don't look it, so I don't have to pay her any more money on that one. But but anyway, yes. Yeah, so basically, and it was all, my stepmother was very intelligent and frustrated, though, because she, all the time she was just like an unpaid servant at home, you know, as a woman. So she was doing all the cooking, all the thing. And by default, I was brought in to be her assistant from 14, you know. I was doing all the cooking, all the washing, all the ironing and all that sort of thing. Obviously we did have electricity in those days, so we weren't doing it up with the mangle, but you know, it was hard work. Actually, it was flipping hard work. And the boys used to just go down the pub, you know, so it was definitely a women's work. And but then I went to university, and you know, I've got degrees, and you know, as we all have, coming out of our ears. But actually what you lose is, you lose that sort of, I'm not saying women should do it, by the way, but the basically the cook's job is hanging vacant on the kitchen door, and nobody's there to do it because everybody's so busy. And you know, that my stepmother, who was very frustrated by the fact she was intelligent and couldn't have an education, and then me, lucky enough to have an education. But somewhere in between, you know, this is, I'm talking for obviously educated people, let alone people who you mentioned probably weren't from the same, you know, socioeconomic kind of strata, if you like. So I don't know what that all means. But the fact is that somewhere we've lost the job of chief cook and bottle washer along the way, which is a societal thing, isn't it? As opposed to just, oh, what's wrong with you? You know, just start cooking kind of idea.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it is societal. And I mean, I was brought up in a very sexist environment. I mean, I've got two brothers. My brothers didn't ever set foot in the kitchen. And actually, I don't think I ever seen either of them do a dish. You know, they were sent through to the front room after Sunday lunch, and you were in the kitchen with your sleeves rolled up. But I do think it's a societal thing. And I think actually, if you look at things from a sort of socioeconomic perspective, people on lower incomes probably buy more takeaway food. And is it because they're fed up and they just go, I just don't have the will to cook? Or is it that it's seen as a sort of, I suppose, you know, we're having Chinese food tonight, is it feels a little bit like, yeah, it's good, you know, Friday night's takeout night. And a lot of the families that we work with, you know, they do have a takeout on a Friday night, but they also don't cook on a Saturday. And actually, would they do a Sunday lunch? Some of them would, but most of them wouldn't. And some of that's economic, because they would think, well, I can't afford a big roast of beef or whatever. But I do think things have got lost along the way. But cooking seen as a chore. People see it as a chore. They see that, so if, whereas actually, wouldn't you be better? I mean, I always look at it as, you know, what good's this going to do my body? I mean, I know I can't, I mean, I'm as guilty as the rest of them. Today I had a scone, a fruit scone, because do you know what? They smelt so good and I just could not resist. So I had a fruit scone, you know, but it's about, for me, it's about, I mean, I don't know. I mean, my kids, I think, are relatively the old cook, I think. But the young people were coming across, they don't even know where the vegetables have come from. And that's the bit that I find absolutely fascinating. 9 times out of 10, they think a courgette's a very, very small cucumber that's gone wrong when you cut it in the middle. You show them and you say, what about this? And they go, that's definitely gone wrong. One of the other things that we're really big on is hydroponics. We do a lot of hydroponic growing. And that's trying to get the young people in to grow things themselves, and then they harvest it and then they cook with it. And no one has ever said no to a kale crisp. No one. You know, and you think that's kale and you're eating it and you're loving it. You know?
Well, I mean, it's a big job ahead, isn't it? I mean, would you say, is it difficult to estimate? I mean, how much of a problem is this? I mean, is it a sort of like 100% problem where it's like, you know, the sirens are going off, we're absolutely going completely down the wrong path? Or do you see it's like a 50% problem, i.e., you know, 50% of people are not engaging, whatever their socioeconomic class? What kind of, you know, on this sort of scale, where are we on that?
I think what I can tell you for a fact is that if food waste was a country in terms of CO2 emissions, it would say China, America, food waste globally. In the UK, 70% of food waste happens in the household. The average family throws out over £700 in monetary terms of food per year. Now, that's the average household. So some people, a lot more. Some people, a lot less. Now, some of the families that people know what's good for them. They're not stupid. They know it's better to have 10 portions of fruit and veg a day. They know that protein's better for them than a great big giant whopping loaf of white bread. They know this. But there's an economic thing there. One of the things for us is if we can prevent people from throwing out, then we can save them money, which means they can buy more. And we often do a sort of almost ready, steady cook with people, say, bring in the bottom of your veg baskets. Now, what we hear time and time again is, I buy it because I know it's good for me and my family, but I don't know what to do with it. So for us, it's quick and easy recipes. It's all about things like slow cooking. It's about actually always shop with a shopping list. We do all these tips. Cook big and freeze. We're really big on that, and particularly for students, cook big and freeze, and then you can still chuck it in the microwave. You know, we just try, I don't know, try as many things as possible. But I do think, where are we? I think in terms of an economic picture that we're in, I think some people go to the food bank because they get a voucher, but it's all ambient. See, we are not about ambient. We're about the other end of the spectrum. But I do think middle class families tend to eat much better than working class families, and that's a fact.
Well, and I suppose it's the middle class people who are tossing all the food in the bin. I mean, you know, I have to say that there was it, I'm thinking, what's his name, Fernley Whittingstall, who did that kind of, like, you know, I don't know if it was him, but sort of just the idea that nobody thinks they're wasting food, actually. Nobody really does. But actually, they are. You know, it's basically a third, I think, chucking it in the bin, he was saying.
It is, and that's absolutely true. And it's everything from bread to potatoes to bananas. I mean, there's a big sliding scale of things that, you know, we chuck in the bin all the time. You know, and we're showing people that actually your apples might go a bit soft. You still bake them. Still make a, you know, an apple puree, make an apple sauce with them. It's just about trying to be canny with it. You know, and I do remember, I mean, I think the way we shop, the buy one, get one frees are a total, it's a rip-off anyway, because you're never going to use it. But actually, I think about how my gran shopped. My gran didn't have a fridge because she didn't really like electricity very much. And she had a piece of slate, it's a big bit of marble. And she'd keep her breads in the pantry, and then she'd have this big bit of marble with the cheese and the butter and all sorts on it, another bit of marble, and she'd put meat on it. Now, my granny shops every day, so buying enough to eat for that meal. Mm. And then she might not shop the next day if she'd enough leftovers. But we do a big weekly shop. And we shop when we're hungry. And we buy all the wrong stuff. And actually, that's one of the big things that we do. It is that teaching people how to shop smart and to buy what they need and not to buy a bag of carrots if they only need three. Just buy three. And actually, we do a big food waste challenge. And so when we're working with people over that 6-week education, and then at the end of the 6 week education, we follow up with them 3 months later, and we follow up with them 6 months later to see how are you getting on, what's changed in your life. But actually, a lot of people are time poor, and that's a big challenge as well.
Yeah, but I think it's also about, I know this for myself, it's sometimes about priority challenge, meaning, you know, there's an awful lot of kind of time that is spent, you know, down some kind of rabbit hole. I mean, it's, you know, with me, it's usually about nutritional rabbit holes. You know, there's a new book out that I've got to listen to on the podcast, you know, and, you know, imagine, I mean, of course, that's just listening, but, you know, imagine how much time we actually, you know, for the time challenged, you know what I mean? Saying, well, actually, are we as time challenged as we really think we are? If we were much more diligent about how we consumed our media, you know, yeah. You know, actually, I know it's a really difficult thing because I think there's always, as I said, it's a societal thing, isn't it? Because, you know, this is about community. This is about small communities. I mean, I'm sure you've read, I can't even remember who it's by now, but it's Soil and Society, which is just a great book about reconnecting community and obviously the importance of the soil in that equation and how it actually manufacturing, you know, small manufacturing, you know, people, those four generations of people who had nothing to do, even if it was making shoes for gnomes, you know, whatever it took, you know, to actually be making shoes or making something in order to feel useful, because then everything goes, doesn't it? You know, you don't have feel, you have a purpose, then why bother to feed yourself well when you could actually be having something that really hits that opiate spot with this very addictive food? So it's this huge thing that actually you're being able to tackle kind of like a branch of this issue and a problem. So if you were a magic fairy, what would you push? You are, Yvonne, a magic fairy. How would you look at this huge problem, and what would you sort of immediately do as the fairy for the day?
I think one of the things that I would immediately do is, I mean, I really like the cleaning, greening and growing. I mean, and I don't grow a lot myself. My mum still has a massive, massive garden and polytunnels. Mum's in her 80s, still does a lot of, you know, cooking her own food. I'd want to do a lot more growing in schools, but I'd also like to bring back proper cookery classes, education, nutrition classes in schools. Now, I know in Scotland, when I was at school, we did everything from, they called it home economics, I don't know what they called it here. And so we learned to sew and we learned to cook a basic meal. Lots of basic meals, but you also understood the nutrition of things and how much protein, how much carbohydrate, how much veg on your plate. So I would want to bring that back because our young people cannot cook. They do not know how to cook because it isn't being handed down to them. But actually that means that then they can't, they're not empowered to look after themselves. They're not empowered to nourish themselves. So what do? They just take the easiest route because, you know, something's better than an empty belly. And I absolutely get that. But if I would want to do that, so I'd want to change the education system. And I'd want people to understand how to nourish themselves because, I mean, we talk here and it does sound a little bit airy-fairy, but we do talk about nourishing the mind, body and soul. But that's what we're all about because we use that food as a medium to talk to people about where they are, what are their issues, how can we help them, can we signpost them? So I think one of the really, really interesting things for me, I suppose, if I had a magic wand, there would be no food insecurity, which is a little bit different from food poverty, because that's the people who can put the food on the table some days, but not every day. So I'd want to combat that food insecurity. I'd want everyone to know how to nourish themselves and how to do stuff quick and easy, you know, but still, you know, have something that's really wholesome for them.
And bringing back the passion into it, because as I say, you know, it's the same for me, which is, you know, obviously, I mean, not obviously, but as a nutritionist as well, maybe, and being called Kate Cook, I'm a great big cook, you know, I love cooking. And even if I don't love it every single day, it is never in my mind to compromise that ever. You know, it's just like, right, you know, you're a bit tired, but roll up the sleeves. And once you get into it, of course, you know, it's a great way to de-stress, you know, I find anyway. So, you know, of course, it's in the culture, it's in my culture, it's in your culture. It's so difficult to just get that joy, as you say, not only of eating that you referred to, but also of actually cooking it, because that's where the disconnect comes often, isn't it? Which is the food is cheap. You know, if you get just one, I don't know, Uber Eats, or I have no idea about these things, but Uber Eats, then I don't know, does it cost a tenner, you know, for something? I don't know. I have no idea. Does it? So in other words, let's say you have a family, maybe you could feel like you could get an Uber Eats round. It's in an instant. You've made a call. It's round and that's it. You haven't done anything for that. You just get the food on your doorstep. I mean, obviously people can't afford to do that every day. But, you know, isn't that sort of, don't people feel that's a sort of, in a way, a cheaper way of making a hamburger than, say, making it from scratch?
I think you're absolutely right. And I think the other thing is, you know, young people love Greggs Bakery. They love it. They all love Greggs. And I don't know what Greggs super recipe
is. Superpower. What's their superpower?
Because anytime you pass Greggs, there's always a queue. It's always young people and they love a Greggs. So I don't know. I mean, I think sometimes for people, the takeaway thing, the luxury of it, the exotic, you know, it could be Thai, it could be something really exotic. And they think, oh, I wouldn't know how to do that. Well, actually, it's quite easy. But for them, you know, and also, are they going to buy a piece of lemongrass? No, probably not. But actually, I don't know what the superpower of Greggs is. And I also don't know when you think about Chinese food and all that monosodium glutamate, you know, and don't get me wrong, I eat Chinese food. But I do just wonder what the disconnect is. Is it because we're so disconnected from where food grows? Is there that disconnect, or is it just that generational something else is more important? For example, television, you know, watching TV, or, you know, playing a game, or I don't know, being on an iPad. Is it that that's much more important? Because the one thing that I can tell you is the dependency on technology is astronomical. People. So if they can't find their telephone, for example, the world has ended. And I always use the anecdote of, you will never know the freedom of going out and no one knows where you are.
Well, I think that is a big thing, because I think it is also about the social, virtual signaling, if you like, whatever that is, from, you know, like, oh, I've just ordered an Uber Eats, it's going to come in 5 minutes. And it's all this sort of an immediacy, this sense of it not being real, you know, and I don't know, you know, you're probably talking to the wrong person, because obviously I'm sort of completely stuck in the old mud, and, you know, I'm from another generation. But even with my daughter, who's 16, trying to, and because of the layout of our house, which is it's 17th century house, it's got a kitchen. It hasn't got a sort of big kitchen that everybody can sit on. It's literally a galley's kitchen kind of idea, with me with the door closed, in effect, doing the cooking like some servant. You know, it's even got a serving hatch, you know? Yeah, I don't say dinner's ready, everybody, you know, come and get it from the serving hatch. But, you know, that's the sort, so she's not as as involved as I'd want her to be. And it's a continual sort of nagging, in effect, to try and get her to make good choices. And obviously she has good dinners, but, you know, she's out and about to her own device. And in a way, she's sort of slightly rebelled against. I mean, I'm not a militant nutritionist at all, but it's kind of like a militancy about sort of just doing the opposite of what your parents are going to do. But, you know, we always sit down to eat at a table. But, you know, I was going to say, you know, sorry, I'm going all over the place here with that. But, you know, just I think it's the immediacy. I think it's the phones. And I also sitting down and sharing a meal, although that's a pleasant experience for me. We're only three, so Emma, me and my husband. You know, in other families, of course, sitting around at a table is that really bad stress where somebody might blow up, you know. So if you've got an unstable family environment where people are drinking and doing things, you know, I wonder if that's got something there, that people just are unwilling to sit round, have the discussions that actually could fire off some very unpleasant background stuff that isn't anything to do with food.
I mean, I think what we do find are that we work with a lot of young people who are either in care due to volatile family situations or in volatile family situations. We come across more and more often young people who self-harm. And I think one of the things there is that there would be absolutely no chance that they would be sitting around a table anyway. And actually, even their bedroom is not a safe place for them. The home is not safe. And actually, they do enjoy the food. They're nervous. Much more nervous, I would say, than sort of children from a stable background. But they enjoy the cooking part, but they would never be able to do it at home. And one of them says, we don't even have any pots and pans at home, and which sort of almost beggars belief on one level, but it's not a complete fantasist thing, because I know it's true. But actually, when you think about it, you know, and one of the kids was saying, actually, there's never anything in our fridge apart from a tub of margarine and maybe a tin of dog food that's for the dog later. And they said, and cornflakes, most common thing in the house, cornflakes. So I do just sometimes, it's sort of beggar's belief, sometimes the things that we hear, but we know they're true, if that makes sense. I don't know. I mean, we've had several incidences when we've cooked with young people and sat around the table where they've thought it was some sort of test to see whether they could use a knife and fork, which for me, you know, you have to rethink these things, because I thought, how could someone think that? So we've had a few volatile situations, and mainly because it's the great unknown, because we haven't sat around the table. You know, and you wonder how they were fed as small children. I do think, I don't know, sometimes I do think it's sort of beggar's belief, but actually what we saw during COVID was Dickensian.
So tell us a little bit about that, because I mean, obviously we've got two, you know, obviously the looking in the rear view mirror, hopefully, is looking at the COVID situation, which I know we came across a little bit of what we were trying to do in Chichester, which is, you know, the so-called restaurant at the boys club. And actually, just as soon as we got you, it's like muscling in on this, but as soon as you got that set up, then there was another lockdown, and it was impacting the very people who obviously you were trying to help. So that was a big problem, presumably, for that period. And coming into this new period where prices are skyrocketing, I'm just wondering, you know, what that's going to look like.
I think there's the big affordability thing, and that's why we're doing the pantries, to try and help people get a little bit more resilient, because it's not just a case of, do I pay my rent or feed my family? It's now, do I pay my rent? Do I pay my utilities, which those bills are going through the roof? Do we pay those as well? And then food comes sort of third. And we, you know, we're still meeting people who are living on hot sweet tea just to try and stave off some of that hunger so that they can feed their families. But the situations that we find during COVID, when we were doing lots of stuff to people's doors, we're doing the pantries now, but we're supporting, is it 1,500 people a week in our pantries? It's huge. And I find all that stuff absolutely staggering. But people are pretty desperate at the moment.
Would you say that's a situation that's got worse? I mean, you know, obviously this was highlighted in the pandemic. I mean, obviously that was presumably a special period. I mean, something where it was an extraordinary for everybody, but particularly people who are vulnerable. And would you say that instead of it kind of like as we move through at least that crisis, that it has not corrected, the position has not corrected for people. So they're still in the same dire straits or getting worse? Or would you say, look, it's evening out now a little bit?
No, it's getting worse. It's absolutely getting worse. And what we're seeing are those families in need. The other thing for me is, you know, to go to a food bank and use a food bank, you need to have a voucher. And a lot of people, pride is a big thing. They're too proud to use the vouchers. So even though they're eligible, they won't use them, but they will come to the pantries and use, you know, it's £2.50 to buy a bag of shopping. They will do that. But actually the need is greater. But actually the other thing about the sort of food rescue side of the world is, the better the supermarkets are getting. You can see it in the way that they structure their sort of reduced sections. So rather than waiting till the day it's gone off, they'll do 2 days before and they'll take it down a little. Then they'll take it down a little bit more the day. So they're trying to cut down on their food waste, and good on them. Although 30 to 40% of what we grow in this country still goes to landfill unless organisations like UK Harvest go and collect it. So I think one of the things for me is I think things are worse. I mean, it does feel slightly as though we're in a sort of almost like a economic depression, but I think it's going to get even worse. And so the other thing for me is I think salaries are going up, particularly in hospitality. We still can't get people to do the jobs. So there's all the economic spin-offs from that. I just think we're in a pickle.
Yes, I mean, in short, it is, it's a pickle because, as I say, it's, you know, the pandemic really has pulled the plug on, you know, so many structures, not least. I mean, we find this in Chichester, the structural things like the church and the, you know, even if you're not religious or whatever, the church does a great job, you know, and lots of churches obviously have really stepped up to the mark and been amazing. Yeah. Not least in Chichester, there's been some amazing things that have happened. But you know, all the things like the Boy Scouts, the Boy Club, the football, where you pick up these, you know, all of these things have been blown out the water, the sort of cobwebs that kept everything together. And that'll take a long time to come back. I think, you know, to reform those social structures is a lot to ask. So you've got that part of it. And secondly, you've got people job insecurity. So a lot of people have been made redundant or lost their jobs during the pandemic. And then the third thing, the prices are going up. It's just like, it seems unsustainable. I think, you know, what would be amazing if, well, I'm thinking of this on the hoof, is actually, you know, maybe coming back onto the show and having a kind of a talk about that food waste specifically and what we can do as nutritional therapists to help people understand that part of the equation from your point of view. What can we do? What can we do immediately in our own families to help that? You know, obviously, you know, I think we're aware, you know, things like soups and you know, freezing stuff and all the rest of it. It'd be great so that we can help our clients, understand that a lot better. That would be amazing. So, you know, can we help with the education of ourselves, first of all? And secondly, you know, so we can pass that on to people that we're able to influence in our circles.
Great. Yeah, love to.
Yeah, that would be a really useful thing. So you know, and sorry, lots. I sort of drifted off there a little bit into that because I got sort of excited by that idea. But yeah, so talking of the food bank, for example, it's that I think I mean, it's difficult, isn't it? Because obviously the food bank is a really useful service for people who are in desperate need. But on the other hand, it's very disempowering for people, I find. You know, it's just like, actually, and again, I'm not a religious person, but I am a community person. So in our church here, we did things like the Harvest Festival. You know, this is in the day, I'm talking a few years back now, but, you know, actually cooking a soup, you know, because the Harvest Festival was very much about bringing a tin along. Of course, the tin would go to the food bank, but the tin along, and that would be like the representation of the harvest. I'm like, that is not the harvest. That is a tin from Heinz. You know, God knows where that came from. Yeah. So it's this idea, this connection to the land and to the food. But also is empowering people to understand that connection to that. The food bank, you know, what's your thought? I mean, obviously it performs a very useful service. What's your interpretation of that?
Okay, so there's two things. One, it does provide a bit of a service to people that are in desperate need. So, and hats off to the food bank for doing that. But it's ambient produce. It's tins, it's packets, there's nothing fresh about it. And so even when we've tried to work, particularly with our local food bank, and said, can you take some apples or what about potatoes? They've said, no, we only do ambient or packet. So the thing for me is, yes, it's better to have something than nothing, but it's not doing anything to help the nutrition of people. So you're not going to change their mindset overnight. And if we want to get societal change to stick, it will take two generations. But we've got to start somewhere. But the food bank perpetuates the packet, the quick, the tin, the mirror, and it takes the joy out of the food as well.
Yeah.
People aren't really appreciating it. So there is a place for the food bank. I think the stigmatisation that goes along with it is outrageous. But also, who makes that decision on who's worthy and who's not? It's like the deserving and the undeserving poor. I struggle with that as a decision.
Yeah, because as I understand it, it's like you're only allowed to have the vouchers so many times a month. So it's not like it's like, well, actually, I've just lost my job, you know, so therefore I probably need it for a couple of months. It's like, no, you only get it three times or whatever it is. It's a sort of finite thing. And then somebody else gets go, which I can completely understand. But I think on the fresh produce or the non-ambient stuff, is it a sort of like a fear or I'm not going to say paranoia about sort of that idea of poisoning someone with non-ambient food? What is the thinking behind saying, no, we can't take apples?
Storage. And the fact that it'll go off. They say, we've not got a lot of storage and it might go off. What if people don't want apples? Well, I don't really know many people that don't really like an apple. But it is that storage. And then they just say, no, it doesn't fit with our model. So it's a no.
And there's nothing to do to change that. No, it's kind of like a shame because obviously you've got, haven't you, there a kind of alliance, you know, because none of these things can happen by ourselves. You know, you were saying with UK Harvest, you know, you do your very best, but in the end, you know, you've got finite resources and a finite manpower and all sorts of finite things that you need to presumably piggyback on other people who can help and take this down the road, because it is a mission. You know, it's not just a sort of, you're not doing it for any other reason, presumably, than just to get this mission out to people and to help them. So what was I going to say? Yes. So basically from us, so as we come up to the top of the hour, sort of top of the hour, we've got a couple of minutes. How can we help? So we've already said perhaps you could come back and we could get one of your people, you know, to teach us what you get, what is taught to about food waste. I think that's a critical part.
Yep.
But otherwise, obviously, people can donate to UK Harvest. How can people get involved if they want to? Obviously, we're a clan of 4,000 nutritional therapists dying to pile in and help. So how can we do that? Just give us some top lines. So
there's several things that, I mean, I think one of the things for us is we're always looking for nutritional expertise. to get involved in either the recipes that we do or our education sessions, or because actually just a fresh pair of eyes on things is always really, really useful. So, and there's volunteering opportunities. People can volunteer with us. They can come along, they can go to a pantry, or they can rock up in London at the hub there and get involved in the education side there. Do a lot of work with refugees and asylum seekers in London and cook food their way. So there's a lot of learning to be had, and I really enjoy those sessions. So there's that, or there is the old adage of, and if anyone can donate anything in any way, shape or form, whether it be time, whether it be money, you know, just whatever, we're always really, really grateful and willing. And also, we have two of these. We always do listen very well. And actually, it's incredible when someone comes along and, you know, looks at things from a different perspective. It's always worth its weight in gold. So please get involved.
So tell us your where to go, your coordinates. So the website maybe, and or an email that's good to get hold of you,
right,
or
so you your team get, on. I think so for volunteering, it's volunteering@ukharvest.org.uk. I'll tell you right now. But I know for me, it's definitely, hang on, I'm just going to look at this. I think it's volunteering. Yeah, it's volunteer. So volunteer@ukharvest.org.uk. Or you can contact me on yvonne.thompson@ukharvest.org.uk. Our website is www.ukharvest.org.uk. But do get in touch, because we'd be absolutely delighted to work with any of you. The more, the merrier.
The more the merrier. And just in case you're looking at the bottom of your screen and trying to spell Thompson, it's without a P. So Thompson in the normal way, but without the P. So just if you're trying to get hold of Yvonne. Well, that was an amazing journey through. Is there anything else you'd want to say, add to any of that?
But I'd love to come back and have another chat. But that'd be great. And it'd be really good if any of your network want to ask any questions. Then it would be great to do a sort of question and answer with you.
Ah, well, we this might be a good thing for you to come back and do, because we're going to do something which is called a cup of tea with me. And that is much more about some of my passions, I mean, including nutritional stuff, obviously, but, you know, it's about forming. It's basically, that is a Q&A, so people can Q&A you, so that would be really good. And also, it's about forming communities, and how do we form resilient communities, and all the rest of it. So it's kind of like my own thing within the network. So that might be a very good vehicle to have that Q&A, and I think that would be really good. We'll follow up on that quite soon, so people can piggyback on this interview as well. Fantastic. Well, listen, that remains for me to say thank you so much, Yvonne, from UK Harvest. So that's Yvonne Thompson and from UK Harvest, doing an amazing job to feed the nation. So thank you.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.